and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at Out North Theater in Anchorage for a talk on coal and your health, given by neurologist and emeritus professor of neurology at the University at Buffalo, Dr. Alan Lockwood. Hosted by Alaska Community Action on Toxics, also known as ACAT, Dr. Lockwood's talk on coal and your health was recorded on February 14th.
Well, good evening. I'd like to say thank you all for coming out this evening. I know it's a special night for some folks. I'm glad you all brought a date. Anyway, so welcome to our public lecture with Dr. Alan Lockwood. He's going to talk about the health problems associated with coal development. My name's Heidi Zimmer. I'm an environmental health coordinator with Alaska Community Action on Toxics. So we've invited Dr. Alan Lockwood here tonight to talk about the health problems associated with coal development through all its stages: mining, transportation, storage, combustion, and disposal of post-combustion waste. And this is a very timely discussion for all Alaskans because our state contains about half of the coal reserves in the U.S. Most of these are in the Western Arctic, but there are also significant coal deposits in the interior on the west side of Cook Inlet and in the Matanuska Valley. Currently, there's only one operating coal mine in Alaska. It's up near Healy. And half of the Healy coal is burned in six small coal-fired power plants in the interior. The rest goes by rail to Seward and is shipped to Asia. Seward residents are concerned about all of the air quality and health problems associated with these coal dust emissions from the loading facility there in Seward. And the coal is transported in open-top train cars that pass from Healy all the way down through Wasilla and Anchorage. So residents in many of these communities are also exposed to coal dust along the way. Coal companies are proposing development of several more controversial mines. There's the Chewitna mine on the west side of Cook Inlet, and the Wishbone Hill in Matanuska Valley are the two that are in the most, they're closest to development. And in addition, the Mental Health Trust recently sold coal leases in Chicoloon. Residents have voiced some serious concerns about the adverse effect these developments will likely have on community health, including damage from coal blasting, coal dust, harm to salmon habitat, and drinking water contamination. So if all of this coal development actually happens, South Central Alaska may become the Appalachia of the North. This coal will not heat Alaskan homes. It will be exported to power plants in Asia, and the toxic emissions from this burning coal will blow back across the North Pacific to contaminate Alaska fish and people with mercury and a variety of other pollutants. So much of Dr. Lockwood's research is on communities in other states and countries, but the strip mines proposed for Alaska, if developed, would cause very similar issues with coal dust and water pollution. So with that in mind, I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight. Dr. Alan Lockwood is an emeritus professor of neurology at the University of Buffalo, a graduate of Cornell University and Cornell University Medical College. Dr. Lockwood is board certified in neurology, a member of the American Neurological Association, and fellow of the American Academy of Neurology. He's the author of approximately 220 publications on diverse scientific topics, including environmental toxicants. He's been an active member of Physicians for Social Responsibility for three decades, was president of PSR National in 1994, and is currently a member of the board and the co-chair of the Environment and Health Committee. He's the principal author of the PSR report, Coal's Assault on Human Health. We have some copies of the executive summary of that available on the table over there. Please feel free to take one. And MIT Press will be publishing a book-length version of this report. It will be coming out later this year. So, that intro, I'd like to introduce you all to Dr. Lockwood.
Well, thank you all very much for coming this evening. Happy Valentine's Day, and a special thank you to ACAT and Cook Inlet Riverkeepers for hosting me here. I'm going to be talking about health, so I thought it would be a reasonable idea to tell you what I thought health is. And this is what the World Health Organization defines health as: a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. So I'd like for you to keep that in mind as I progress through here, because I'm going to be talking mainly about diseases that you might go to see your doctor about. Hopefully you won't. But also think about the mental health aspects of some of the diseases that I'm going to be talking about, and some of the mental health aspects of just living in an environment where you're worried and concerned about the quality of the air that you breathe, the water that you drink, and the environment that you raise your, where that you live in and where you may be raising your children. I never thought I'd see the day when I'd be quoting Donald Rumsfeld, but here it is. He said, there are things we know that we know, and there are things that we know that we don't know, but there are also unknown unknowns. There are things that we do not know that we don't know. So at my wife's urging a couple of weeks ago, I thought I would start my talk this evening with a quick overview of how scientific knowledge is developed and sort of the way scientists and physicians evaluate the evidence that we see in medical journals and encounter in day-to-day in our day-to-day practice and our day-to-day existence. So let me start with two different examples. So an individual who lives near a coal mine develops chronic lung disease. Did living near the mine cause this chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or not? And this is the kind of anecdotal, or in evidence-based medicine, a case report that we encounter all of the time. Another example starts with a hypothesis as opposed to an observation. And the question is, does living near a coal mine affect your health? And for that, I'll use as an exemplar a study by Hendricks, who I understand has been here in the past, and Ahern in a study of a cohort of West Virginians. So the hierarchy of medical evidence starts at the top with the gold standard, the randomized clinical trial. In a randomized clinical trial, or an RCT, you establish an outcome measure before you begin the study. You enroll participants that meet certain criteria for enrollment, and you don't enroll people who don't meet those criteria. You randomize the participants to either a treatment or an exposure or to some other alternate, like a placebo. You have to conceal and protect the randomization code so that you can't guess who's going to be getting the real thing or the placebo the next time around. And you evaluate the data with appropriate statistical tests. And at the end of the day, if you're lucky and everything works out right, you come out with an answer to your hypothesis. Is the treatment or the exposure different than the placebo or the non-exposure? Now, the only thing that's better than a randomized clinical trial is a meta-analysis of multiple randomized clinical trials. But the randomized clinical trial is really the gold standard for medical evidence and scientific evidence, as opposed to a case report, which is at the bottom of the hierarchy, which is the person who lives next to the coal mine and develops chronic lung disease and wonders whether that living next to the coal mine caused that particular condition. It's an observation. You can generate a hypothesis with it, but you cannot use that kind of data to test a hypothesis to determine whether or not something is true or not. And the same is pretty much true for case series, which is multiple case reports. So you might go down the street and say, well, my neighbor also has chronic lung disease, and he also lives next to the coal mine. So now we've got at least two, maybe three, four, or even sometimes a dozen or more observations. Next step up on the rung, this is a case series is a little bit better than a case report because you know that it's at least not an isolated incident. There has to be at least two or so cases to make a case series. An ecological association occurs, or is the kind of study where you look at existing data about exposure or the pollutant and the incidence of a disease like diabetes or chronic lung disease. That is better than a case series, but it's still not very high up the hierarchical ladder. As soon as you get to case control or cohort studies, you begin to generate data that have real value in terms of testing a hypothesis and determining whether or not there's a reasonable probability that that hypothesis is true. And there are a couple of kinds of cohort studies. There's a retrospective type of study where you examine predominantly existing data, or a prospective study, which is a more powerful one because you start off at some point and you acquire new data as time goes by. And I'll show you some examples of these as we go along. Well, why not do randomized clinical trials all of the time, since that's the gold standard? Well, there are a number of reasons for that. First of all, it may not be feasible because of ethical or practical constraints. For example, no one would randomize someone to cigarette smoking versus non-cigarette smoking to look at lung cancer these days. It would be unethical to do that. Sort of the typical example of a non-ethical type of study would be to determine whether or not using a parachute protects you if you jump out of an airplane at 10,000 feet. I mean, you know what the answer to that is going to be based on other principles like gravity, and you know that if you jump out of an airplane without a parachute on, you know, it's going to be curtains. So under those circumstances, it's not ethical to do a trial of that. And under other circumstances, it just may not be practical to do a randomized clinical trial. They're very expensive. They take long periods of time. And you may have heard about that in reports of how much money drug companies spend in drug development. And a good deal of that money is spent on the randomized clinical trials that are required before the FDA will approve a drug. So that there need to be alternatives. And this is the major source of information that I'm going to be talking to you now about tonight, are studies that are not quite up to the gold standard of the randomized clinical trial. They're going to be largely cohort studies. So how do you know whether evidence that is developed as the result of one of these cohort studies can be implicated in a causal relationship? And there are several principles that allow you to make that determination, one of the most important, is the strength of the association. And that's usually measured as the result of a statistical test that tells you that the probability is less than 1 in 20 that the result that you got is different from the control due to chance alone. Other things to consider are the consistency of the result. Is this the replication of another study? And if there is a replication, then the strength for a causal relationship becomes greater. And that's why it's important in science that and in medicine that not just one study is sufficient. It's very important in most cases to be able to replicate the study. There are other things like biological plausibility. In the case of smoking cigarettes, you know that the first time you smoke a cigarette, you cough. Right? It's probably not good for you. So it's plausible that smoking cigarettes may not be good for your health. Temporality, the time between the exposure to the development of a disease is important in some instances. But many of the conditions that I'm going to be talking about tonight, like the development of atherosclerosis, for example, or the development of chronic lung disease, are the result of years and years of sustained exposure. So temporality may not be always evident at the beginning. And then there are other things like the dose response. Is it worse to smoke 2 packs a day than it is to smoke 1 pack a day? If you stop smoking, do your lungs get better? Those are the kinds of things like the dose response, the effects of cessation, and other things. So all of these things get folded together, and many scientific organizations and medical societies like the American Academy of Neurology have a scale that they use to rate the quality of evidence in the practice guidelines that are published by the American Academy of Neurology that serve as a guide to neurologists as they confront everyday conditions in their office, like how do you treat headaches? What are the most effective approaches to treating a patient with epilepsy? And it's the strength of the evidence that determines how steadfast the guideline is and how well one should adhere to it. So we're left, for the most part, in epidemiological studies with case control studies, where you identify a case, like somebody with chronic lung disease, and then you identify controls that are matched by age, gender, and perhaps other effects, and look to determine whether or not there's a difference in the prevalence of the disease in the identified cases and the controls. And this usually includes a retrospective analysis of exposure, and all retrospective analyses are subject to bias. Bias is the major enemy in evidence-based medicine, and it's very, very difficult to eliminate all sources of bias. So there are differences between retrospective studies, where the direction of inquiry goes to the past and uses existing data, or in some cases in cohort studies, where you enroll a person at the beginning of the study, and then you follow them with standard examinations periodically to determine whether or not that individual develops a disease based on the, and you also have evidence about exposure and disease as an endpoint. And these are the more powerful kinds of studies. And a good example of that is the Women's Health Initiative, and I'll be showing you an example from that study in a few minutes. So let's look at I've alluded to the fact that the man who lives near a coal mine and develops chronic lung disease, that's a case report. That's the weakest form of evidence. The study of Hendricks and Ahern, which was published in a very reputable peer-reviewed journal, is an example where they had the hypothesis that living near a coal mine may cause health effects. So what they did was they used a very sophisticated telephone survey method using geographical information, data that identified where the person lived and enabled them to link that with information from other sources about coal production in that area in mines in West Virginia. And they had excellent control for confounding variables in the statistical analysis, which is always an important part. And what they found was that coal production increased, as coal production increased, health status worsened and rates of cardiopulmonary disease, lung disease, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and kidney disease all worsened. And one of the examples that they list in their publication is a result for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. This is emphysema and chronic bronchitis. And in this kind of study, you wind up with an odds ratio and confidence limits. So they report that if you lived in an area where less than 4 million tons of coal were mined per year, you had a 0.9 something or other probability of developing chronic lung disease. And the confidence limits here go from about 0.6 to about 1.5. It's about 1. But if you lived in an area where there was more than 4 million tons of coal mined per year, the probability of developing chronic lung disease was 1.56 or so. And the confidence limits are both greater than 1, 1.069 to 2.27. In other words, if you were able to do this 95 times, the result would fall between those two confidence limits 95% of the time. The fact that the lower confidence limit is greater than zero is an indicator of statistical significance. So they're able to conclude with better than one chance in 20 that this result is not due to chance alone. So with this as an introduction, let's switch now from this hierarchy of medical evidence to the topic at hand tonight, which is coal and the health effects that our reliance on coal as an energy source create. At the present time, the most recent data from the Institute for Energy Information, which is a part of the federal government, indicates that somewhere around 43% of all of the energy that's used to generate electricity comes from burning coal. About 23% comes from natural gas. The amount that's from coal is going down, natural gas is going up. About 20% comes from nuclear, and the small minority from other sources like hydroelectric, wind power, and renewable sources. So the fact that close to half of all of the energy that we use for electricity comes from burning coal makes information about coal and health effects relevant to Americans. And this table shows some of the data from a study that was published by one of the most influential peer-reviewed medical journals, The Lancet, in 2007. And in their analysis of data that were available for Europe, for every terawatt of electricity produced, somewhere between 25 and 30 or so deaths occurred as associated with burning the coal. Lignite is a form of coal, and other coals include bituminous coal, which is the kind of coal that will be mined from the Wishbone mine if that ever starts happening. Most of the coal that's mined in the United States is either bituminous, sub-bituminous, or lignite, not very much anthracite. So when you take these data, somewhere around 25 or 30 deaths per terawatt, and consider that in the United States we generate around 4,000 terawatts of electricity per year, you begin to see that there are appreciable health effects just in the form of deaths, let alone the major illnesses and the minor illnesses that can be associated with that. So with that as sort of an introduction to the magnitude of the problem, let me now just go briefly through some of the various stages of the life cycle of coal. And let me start with mining coal itself. Now, there aren't very good data that I've been able to find in the peer-reviewed medical literature about the kind of exposures that you all are the most concerned about. You know, when a train goes by my house that's carrying coal and dust comes out of that train car and settles in my front yard and my child goes outside and plays there, is this a hazard to the health of my child? I would submit that it is, because there probably is no safe level for coal dust, in that in the same manner that there's no safe level for exposure to any of the other environmental toxicants that I'm going to talk to you about. But in terms of data that are available in respected peer-reviewed medical literature, the most data that are available have to do with coal workers' pneumoconiosis or black lung disease. And there are three diagnostic criteria that have to be met for that condition to be diagnosed. There has to be chest X-ray evidence that's consistent with coal workers' pneumoconiosis. There has to be sufficient occupational exposure to coal dust. And you have to rule out other causes. I mean, that makes it rule out everything else, and the only thing that you're left with is the coal workers' pneumoconiosis. Nevertheless, that's how this disease is classified and the criteria for its diagnosis. And the prevalence of coal workers' pneumoconiosis is around 1% among underground mine workers with 9 or fewer years of experience working in underground mines. And it rises to just over 5% among those with 25 or more years of underground mining experience. So there are a couple of things here that are take-home messages, and one of them is that it appears to take a lot of exposure to coal dust before you develop this terrible, life-threatening disease. But even the small amount is probably not good for you. There's no reason to believe that it is good for you. None of these things are good for you. Now, in 1969, as the result of the perception of correctly that there was an epidemic of black lung disease among coal miners, a federal law was passed that limited the exposure to coal dust to a certain amount and also established X-ray screening programs to identify people who were at risk, or to survey people who were at risk, and identify minors who had early forms of coal workers' pneumoconiosis. And as a result of that, as you see in these three panels here, between the 1970s, 1980s, and the 1990s, the prevalence of black lung disease fell, except for the people who are in this red bar here. And the red bar are miners who work in small mines, defined in this study as mines that have 50 or fewer employees. So the federal regulations have helped reduce the prevalence of black lung disease, but among the less well-regulated and the less well-surveyed small mines, there's been a reversal of this early trend and an increase in the prevalence of black lung disease, which is a cause for concern and has been attributed by some authors to a relaxation in the standards and the enforcement of the existing regulations from this 1969 law. Now, the next step in the process is typically washing coal and then transporting coal to from the mine site. And about 70% of all railroad traffic in the United States is related to transporting coal. Railroad accidents with fatalities are much more common per ton mile than road traffic. Diesel locomotives that are used to pull trains emit particulates that are harmful to health. Diesel exhaust particles are particularly nasty. Trucks that and tugboats that push barges that are responsible for the other 30% of coal transport also produce particulates, either from their diesel engines or wear and tear on roads. And I'll come back to this road wear and tear, which is a leading source of fine particles that are an important adverse health impact. Now, in the late 1900s, the Congress directed the Environmental Protection Agency to identify the hazardous air pollutants that were released by burning coal, and there are at least 67 or 68 of these. And the most important of these are oxides of sulfur and nitrogen, arsenic, beryllium, cadmium, chromium, including chromium-6, which is the Aaron Brockovich form of chromium, mercury, nickel, hydrochloric acid, hydrofluoric acid, acrylin, which is an organic volatile organic compound, dioxins, formaldehyde, and there's also small amounts of uranium and thorium, which are both radioactive elements in coal. So all of these things come out of the stacks of coal-fired power plants. And one of the ironies in this whole business is that as environmental protection gets stronger and the emissions from coal-fired power plants go down, all of these toxicants that used to go out the chimney are now trapped in coal combustion waste and form this increasingly important and hazardous waste stream as coal combustion waste. And I'll come back to that in a few minutes, right now, in fact. We burn about 1 trillion tons of coal each year in the United States. How many of you in the audience thought we burned that much coal? A trillion tons of coal is one heck of a lot of coal, and about 10% of all coal is ash. So we generate about 100 million tons of coal combustion waste each year. And at the present time, this is not classified at all, or is not subject to any kind of federal regulation in terms of how it has to be handled once it becomes coal ash. Now, workers who work with coal ash in power plants are required to wear respirators and disposable clothing that, like this Tyvek that you wrap houses with to protect them from exposure to that. But once it gets out there into the pile, it's pretty much unregulated. And this is been a real hotbed of contention at the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA is in the process of developing a regulation that's possibly in final form. The public comment period ended a while ago, but a final regulation has not been issued by EPA. EPA received more public comments about this regulation than any other regulation they've proposed. So this has been a galvanizing issue for Americans all across the country. They had several more large public meetings that were attended by people. And each of you as a citizen can, if you know how to do it, and it's not very hard, respond to these proposed regulations by emailing a comment that goes into the docket that EPA officials consider when they're developing regulations.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with neurologist and professor of neurology, Dr. Alan Lockwood. His talk on coal and your health was recorded at an event hosted by Alaska Community Action on Toxics on February 14.
Now, the most famous of the coal ash disasters occurred on December 22nd in 2008 when a dam that held back an 84-acre area of coal ash slurry, where coal ash is mixed with water, failed, and a 1.1 billion gallons of this slurry were released into the surrounding areas, including the Clinch and Emery rivers. What's not known very much about the Kingston's business is that for years before this spell, which created a huge amount of attention in the media, but for years and years before that, heavy metals like arsenic, beryllium, barium were being released into groundwater, and that was going into the Clinch and Emery rivers, being exported as landfill, including to a school in the nearby area that received landfill that contained 3/4 of a ton of barium and over 250 pounds of each of a variety of toxic heavy metals. And I called the school and talked to a school official, and this was in 1999 that this happened, and these people were completely unaware of the fact that their school property had this landfill existed, and that that their school property had all of these toxic metals on it. So these are data from a publication called The Hidden Costs of Energy that was released by the National Academy of Sciences in 2009. And their estimate is that these hidden costs, which are all health costs basically, amounts to about $62 billion per year. So this reinforced the study from Europe that was published in Lancet that I mentioned before. And on this map of the United States, you see all these dots. They didn't include Alaska in here for reasons that are not known to me. But the size of the dot is proportionate to the health care costs. And some of these old coal-fired power plants are responsible for as much as $500 million per year of healthcare costs that are associated with that. And as you can see here, most of those are located along the Ohio River and the Mississippi River and valleys and along the eastern seaboard of the United States. Now, these are what are referred to as the major pollutants that affect health. These are what EPA calls the criteria pollutants. And when the Clean Air Act was passed and when the EPA was created in the Nixon administration, the EPA was charged with identifying air pollutants that represented the largest threats to health. And these are now referred to as criteria pollutants. And these include carbon monoxide, lead, nitrogen dioxide, which is a precursor to ground-level ozone, particulate matter, ozone itself, sulfur dioxide, and not included among the criteria pollutants, but also very important, is mercury, and I'll spend some time talking about mercury in a minute. Now, sulfur dioxide, clearly, as you may not be able to read the print here, but you can get some idea of the magnitude of the effect here. By far, and by a factor of about four, Electricity generation is the leading source of sulfur dioxide. And the reason for that is that all coal contains a substantial amount of sulfur. Some of the coal in China is more than 10% by weight of sulfur. Alaskan coal is relatively low in sulfur content, and that's one of the reasons why it's desirable by the Chinese and Asian coal-fired power plant people, because it does produce substantially less sulfur dioxide when it's burned. Now, sulfur dioxide itself is an irritant to the lungs, but perhaps more importantly, this sulfur dioxide, which is a gas, when it gets into the atmosphere, it combines with other atmospheric constituents to form small particles. And as time has gone by, it becomes increasingly clear that these small particles are probably the single most important threat to health that's the result of air pollution. Small particles, those with an aerodynamic of less than 2.5 microns or millionths of a meter in size, are produced from a number of sources, but burning fossil fuels is among the top three or four. Road dust, which is just the dust that's caused by the studded tires that you all use in Alaska, which are illegal in most of the rest of the United States, is the leading source. But these road dust is going to be churned up by the trucks that will be hauling coal from mine sites to potential sites where it's shipped elsewhere. This map is the result of the application of new technology, which makes it possible to measure the concentration of these small particles from satellites. And the only reason that Alaska is not here is because the orbits of the satellites don't include Alaska. They stop before, they don't go that far north. So that they don't look at you all here close, but not quite. But you can see that there's a very strong resemblance of this map to the map from the National Academy of Sciences about the hidden costs of coal, largely in the Ohio Valley and along the eastern seaboard. And you see Mexico City down there, where there's a large amount of pollution that's the result of automobile traffic. So particulate matter has been linked to a number of important health problems. In very large replicated studies, like the Harvard Six Cities study, the American Cancer Society Cancer Prevention Study, and another important study that involves Seventh-day Adventists who were surveyed because their religious affiliation discourages very strongly the smoking of cigarettes, so that source of adverse health effect was limited there. All three of those really big studies showed a significant relationship between the amount of air pollution and a variety of health outcomes. Other studies have shown increases in acute myocardial infarcts with increasing exposure to small particles, discharge of defibrillators that are linked. The time can be linked with a peak in small particle concentration. These defibrillators all have little chips in them a discharge of a defibrillator is not something that you fail to notice, an extraordinarily painful experience. So people know when these things happen. They go to the hospital, the technician hooks them up to a machine, they can see exactly when the defibrillator went off, and they can using EPA or similar data, see what the concentration of small particles was on that hour and that particular day and make linkages. Particulate air pollution is also linked to hospital admissions. And a study of 60 Northeast counties in the United States, there are, again, significant relationships between admissions for stroke, myocardial infarction, congestive heart failure, and several other endpoints. Now, these are relatively small increases on the order of a percent or so, but when you consider the size of the Medicare population and how many people there are in that population, which I'm now a part of, like some of you in the audience, this becomes large numbers of people and the health costs that are associated with that become increasingly important. So air pollution can be shown as a contributing factor to the four leading causes of death in the United States. Heart disease, which is the leading cause of death in the United States, myocardial infarcts, congestive heart failure, fatal arrhythmias, malignant neoplasms, the second ranked cause of death in the United States, respiratory diseases, recently promoted from fourth to third leading cause of death in the United States, asthma, particularly in kids, stroke, fourth leading cause in the United States, is also linked to air pollution, particularly small particles. So let me change now to mercury. Burning coal is the single most important anthropogenic source of mercury emissions in the world. These are data from the United Nations Global Mercury Assessment, which was published in 2008. Coal contains mercury. When it's burned, the mercury goes up the stack. The reason that mercury is of importance is that it exerts deleterious effects on the developing human brain, particularly children in utero. Doubling the mercury concentration reduces neurodevelopment scales by between 5% and 16%, a percent of a standard deviation. Using conservative measures, the annual lost productivity costs due to mercury is somewhere around $8.7 billion per year. and the EPA data from recent studies indicates that the most highly exposed individuals in the United States, mercury may reduce IQ between 7 and 11 points. These are on the 10% of the most highly exposed people in the low socioeconomic groups in the southeastern part of the United States, where the physical conditions for the formation of methylmercury from mercury are best. This is another map from the United Nations Global Atmospheric Mercury Assessment showing patterns of mercury deposition largely in the northern hemisphere. Again, here you see eastern United States where large numbers of coal-fired power plants are, and this plume of mercury that goes out into the Atlantic Ocean. And over here you see eastern Europe, Asia, particularly China and India, which are burning increasingly large amounts of coal as they become more and more industrialized. Alaska does make it onto this map here. Luckily for y'all, this is mercury deposition rates in Alaska are not the highest as they are in other places. And this figure, also from the same atmospheric mercury assessment, shows a modeling of the pattern of mercury dispersion and deposition as a result of a release that takes place in eastern Asia. So you can see here the prevailing westerly winds carry this mercury up across into through the Aleutians into southern parts of Alaska and western parts of the United the continental United States and Canada. So mercury, although most mercury falls to the ground relatively close to the site where it's emitted, it's a very heavy metal, there is a great deal of it that is transported for longer distances. And when it's transported, it comes to the ground in wet deposition, and here's another map of mercury deposition showing again the hot spots in the United States, particularly in the, along the Mississippi and Ohio valleys. It's brought down to the ground in rain, and that's where the problem begins. So mercury comes out of the smokestacks of coal-fired plants. it's brought to the ground in rain, and in bodies of water, bacteria convert inorganic mercury, elemental mercury, into methyl mercury, which is the form that bioaccumulates as it moves up the food chain. And methyl mercury is extremely toxic to the nervous system, much more so than inorganic or elemental mercury. So as small fish eat plankton, and the small fish are eaten by increasingly large fish, the concentration of mercury increases. And the principal source route of exposure to mercury among Americans is by eating fish. And that's a way that you can reduce your exposure to this toxic metal, is by judicious choice of fish that you consume. And unfortunately, mercury is concentrated by the fetus, so that fetal concentrations of methylmercury are about 1.7 times higher than they are in maternal blood. And these are studies that have been done on the cord blood of newly born babies where the cord blood is collected at the time of birth. And so you can get a simultaneous sample of both maternal and fetal mercury. And this is a figure that shows how mercury bioaccumulates. So this is a logarithmic scale, and from here to here is a concentration increase of about a factor of 1 million. So as methylmercury starts off in the water, it then goes into phytoplankton and zooplankton, and then as the plankton are consumed by increasingly large species of fish, it increases in concentration, and the fraction of the mercury that's present as methylmercury also increases. And the last species in this particular slide is loons. This was a study that was done in loons, which are feed on large fish in the lakes of northeastern United States. And the concentration of mercury in the loons is about a million times higher than it is in the water. Now, luckily, we don't eat loons, but if you eat these large fish that have large amounts of mercury in it, you will get exposed to this neurotoxin. Now, fortunately for Alaskans, most species of Alaska fish, according to your Department of Health and Social Services, including all five wild Alaska salmon species, contain very low mercury levels that are not a health concern. And these are all direct quotes from their report. And they surveyed almost 360 women of childbearing age from 51 different communities around Alaska as a part of its 2002 to 2006 monitoring program. And none of these individuals had mercury levels of clinical or public health concern as a result of eating fish from Alaska. And they conclude that women who are or can become pregnant, nursing mothers, and children aged 12 years and under should continue unrestricted consumption of fish from Alaska waters that are low in mercury, which include all five species of Alaska salmon. Hopefully before I go back to Buffalo, I'll have a chance to eat some of your Alaska salmon. Pacific cod, walleye pollock, black rockfish, and other species, including small halibut and ling cod that are less than 30 inches long, are all safe to eat in essentially unlimited quantities. And eating fish is an important source of omega-3 fatty acids, which are an essential for normal neurodevelopment. Now let me shift gears here and talk just a little bit about the Clean Air Act. It was signed in 1970 during the administration of Richard Nixon, and amended significantly in 1990 during the administration of George H.W. Bush. In 1970, the Clean Air Act and the accompanying legislation established the EPA, whose mission is to protect human health and the environment, and establish the National Ambient Air Quality Standards for those six criteria pollutants that I mentioned before. The 1990 amendments established the acid rain program and gave EPA the authority to regulate point sources, power plants, and also mobile sources. And that's the origin of the CAFE standards, the corporate average fuel economy standards that are now enforced for automobiles and trucks. So this is a figure from one of the studies that was mandated by Congress as a part of the Clean Air Act to assess the impact of the Clean Air Act on and costs and effectiveness and benefits of the Clean Air Act. And here we have the first enactment of the Clean Air Act in 1970 and then the 1990 amendments. And as you see here, as time goes by, the Clean Air Act has become more and more effective at and leading up to improvements in the quality of the air. And it's these acts and these regulations that are a part of the result of the Clean Air Act that are now under dreadful assault in the particularly the House of Representatives of the United States, where environmental regulation and regulation of any kind is seen as a pariah and something that's anti-American. This figure shows EPA data for the amount of sulfur dioxide in red and nitrogen oxides in green emitted per year since the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990 became effective in 1995. As you can see, there's been a steady decrease in the emission of these two compounds. The oxides of nitrogen are particularly important because they're the precursor to ground-level ozone. In sunlight, nitrogen oxides plus volatile organic compounds, and we emit about 18 million pounds of volatile organic compounds in the United States each year, forms ground-level ozone, and ground-level ozone is an important irritant. Something like 120 million Americans live in an area where ozone standards are, present-day ozone standards are not met. And some of you may remember that late last year, the EPA was all set to issue new standards for ozone concentration, but the present administration of President Obama curtailed that release and postponed it for at least 2 years. It would have made it even more stringent and classified more and more people in the United States as living in non-attainment areas for the ozone standard. So these are some of the health effects that have been avoided by the Clean Air Act as amended. These are annual figures. In the year 2010, 160,000 deaths per year avoided, 13 million lost days of work avoided, and by the year 2020, the estimates are that 230,000 deaths per year will be avoided as a result of the Clean Air Act, and something like 17 million lost days of work will be avoided. And these are the translating those numbers into dollars and cents. I see those as patients that I used to take care of in my clinics and the emergency rooms. Economists look at them in terms of dollars and cents. And by 2020, the estimated annual benefits from the Clean Air Act are on the order of $2 trillion per year. $2 trillion a year of money that we don't have to pay for healthcare expenditures and for cleaning up the environment. And this goes a long way to solving some of the problems that we face with the soaring national debt. The cost of this, so about $65 billion a year. $65 billion a year is a not inconsequential amount of money. But I don't know about you all, but I don't have any investments that have a cost-benefit return that's as good as spending $65 billion to prevent an adverse outcome and getting $2 trillion back per year. These are really astounding numbers, and numbers that are largely lost in some of the raging debates about the unbearable costs of environmental regulations. The estimated fraction of the $65 billion a year that will be attributed to coal plants is somewhere on the order of $10 billion a year. So let me finish up here with just a few things about global warming. Every single model of projected changes in temperature that has been run by reliable climatologists predicts that the very high latitudes and the very low latitudes around the South Pole, I mean by low latitudes, are going to be the areas where global warming and temperature changes are going to be the most severe. And one of the reasons for that is the carbon dioxide emissions, including the carbon dioxide emissions by the United States, are growing steadily. China now leads the United States and is adding about one new coal-fired power plant per week. But the emissions from of carbon dioxide in the United States continue to rise, but may show some evidence of plateauing. And global warming is already having important effects on the economy and health. And this is just one of many things that I could tell you about, but shows an association between changes in temperature and agricultural yields of the four most important food crops that are grown in the world: maize, which is corn, rice, wheat, and soy. And in China and Brazil, corn yields have gone down by almost 10% associated with changes in temperature. Wheat yields in the Soviet Union and Russia have gone down by about 15% associated with changes in temperature. These data don't include the results that are almost surely going to be seen on rice yields in Southeast Asia due to the terrible floods that occurred there during the monsoon season that came last year. These are just one of the many ways that global warming is affecting health by affecting the nutritional status in parts of the world where nutrition is already marginalized. In areas of the tundra, the effects of global warming are potentially catastrophic if the enormous stores of methane gas that are trapped in crystalline form are released into the atmosphere. There's 1.7 billion tons of methane. And this shows an area of tundra collapse that's due to the release of some of the methane that's stored in sequestered form in frozen ground. Methane is important as a global warming gas. It's depending upon how many years you think about post-emission, it's between 20 and 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide, which is the most important of all of the global warming gases because there's so much more of it than the others. But if methane releases from the tundra melting and release of all this methane, it's possible that this can create a situation from which recovery cannot be obtained, an irreversible state of global warming. So climate change is real and it's caused by human activity, and if there are questions, I'd be glad to show you exactly how that evidence has been produced, and there's very multiple ways of showing it, and it's very persuasive. It's not just that temperatures are going up and carbon dioxide levels are going up. There's very, very good evidence that burning fossil fuels is the source of the methane, of the carbon dioxide that's causing global warming. Climate change is bad for us and our communities, regardless of where you live. We need to act now to protect those who are vulnerable, particularly those who live in some of the delta areas like the Nile Delta, the deltas of the Yangtze River, and the rivers in the Ganges and Brahmaputra rivers in India, where millions of people face displacement as sea levels rise, and whole nations, particularly in the South Pacific, will be completely inundated and cease to exist if sea levels rise the way they're anticipated to rise. So taking action creates a win-win situation, and solutions to climate impact and improve health as well as preserving the environment. So with that, I'd like to thank you again for giving up your Valentine's Day Eve to come out here. Here may be what's bad news, but there are things that you can do and should be doing to do your part in saving energy and reducing the burden of disease that's caused by burning fossil fuels. This is a photograph of the roof of our home in Buffalo, where we have a 4.4 kilowatt photovoltaic array that generates about 80% of the electricity that we use. We have now two Prius cars, and we're in the process of trading our compact fluorescent bulbs for LEDs when those no longer work. So again, thank you all. the people who have been my gracious hosts, and you all for coming out this evening. Thank you very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with neurologist and professor of neurology at the University of Buffalo, Dr. Alan Lockwood. Alaska Community Action on Toxics hosted his talk on Coal and Your Health at Out North Theater in Anchorage on February 14th, 2012. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.